from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Leaf peeping, it's a New England fall tradition. The reds, yellows, even purples of turning leaves set against autumn afternoon light can make for gorgeous photos. Now, those pictures can do more than adorn your walls or maybe just sit around on your hard drive. Stephanie Spera is an assistant professor of geography and environment at the University of Richmond, and she wants your old fall foliage photos to better understand climate change. Stephanie, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with basics. Why do leaves change these beautiful colors in the fall to begin with?
Yeah, so leaves are green to begin with because they make chlorophyll. And what chlorophyll does is it turns that CO2 into the oxygen we love and the sugar that they need to survive. So once the days start getting shorter and the temperatures start to cool down, they stop that chlorophyll production. And what happens is then that green pigment breaks down and the oranges and yellows that have been there the whole time, we can actually see them.
So this is really just a process of unmasking the yellows and oranges that were there all along.
Yes, totally. And then some trees, like maples, they produce something called anthocyanin, and that's what gives it that red pigment. And some people think that cooler nights actually leads to increased production of that red pigment. So all trees have those yellows and oranges. Only some trees make the reds, which is why they're so spectacular.
So you've already hinted at one possible connection between the color of the leaves and climate change. You said cooler nights might make for more red pigment, but lay some of this out. How would climate change potentially affect fall foliage coloration?
Yes, there's a lot that is going on. But the two cues that trees get to stop really making that green chlorophyll is day length and temperature. And once those cues become unsynced, which one could imagine with temperature increasing, we don't actually know what's going to happen on the broader level with fall foliage. A lot of the studies that have been done are species specific, but some people have linked an earlier bud burst in the spring to a later fall foliage season. Usually dry falls end in a later and shorter season. Actually, some rain and some cloudiness is good for that red production. So there's a lot of different variables that we're going to try and disentangle at a very broad scale because we're looking at Acadia National Park as a whole.
Why would an early bud burst in the spring be linked to a later change in color in the fall? Or is that just a reflection that the whole year has gotten warmer and that season has gotten longer?
I think it's exactly that. We're seeing the temperatures increase in the shoulder season. So those trees that really rely on those temperature cues, their bud bursts, their buds are bursting. What a fun phrase. Their buds are bursting earlier, and then they're not getting those temperature cues to shut down their chlorophyll production until later.
Well, Stephanie Spera, one of the things that you're really interested in getting at is not necessarily the biological, but actually some of the economic implications. This is big business. This brings visitors to New England. So how do you connect all the dots there, all the way from climate change to the color of leaves to the economic impacts?
We're doing this in a few different ways. But basically, we're interested in how temperature and precipitation have changed in Acadia National Park over time, if that's affected fall foliage. And what we've seen in Acadia, actually, is visitorship double in September and October since 1990. So we actually have people in the park giving out visitor surveys, asking if fall foliage is even a thing they consider when planning their October and September trips. The cruises that go to Bar Harbor bring in millions of dollars to that region. And a lot of things actually close down on Indigenous Peoples Day, that people consider that the end of the season. But there are implications there that if the fall foliage is happening later and later, how much do you want to put into planning your trip a year in advance? Should businesses stay later open? So we're doing this interdisciplinary, top-down level approach where we're looking at the observational data, the meteorological data, the fall foliage data, but then we're also asking people, what do you think about when you plan your trip to Acadia in the fall?
And do they think about fall foliage?
We have techs in the park right now asking those questions, and I have not looked at any of the results. This is a happening as we speak survey.
You know, I personally love Acadia National Park, but I'm curious why that spot in particular for this type of study.
Yes. Well, I selfishly knew I was moving to Virginia, and I'm from New England, and I wanted a reason to go back to Maine in the fall. And it is my favorite national park. I've been to a few, and I love it so much. So any science that would get me into the park and help preserve it, help it from a park management standpoint, I was all about.
So Stephanie Spera, assuming that these current surveys show that people do consider fall foliage when making their decisions about when and whether to come to places in New England like Acadia National Park, the next question is fall foliage changing over time because of climate change? How do you actually start to answer that question?
Yeah, so the first thing we have to do is actually see if the timing of the onset and peak of fall foliage is changing at all. So we have satellite data that'll get us back until the year 2000 to actually be able to tease that apart. There are satellites circling the globe every day, taking pictures essentially of the Earth. So we can actually see the colors change over time and when they change. So we're starting that analysis now. The problem is the consistent satellite data, the daily satellite data, only gets us back to the year 2000. Which 20 years is good for a trend, but ask anyone, they'll be like, last year was an awful fall foliage year. We got no leaves. This year is great. So the more data we have, the less noise there is, the more we can back out a trend. So this is where we also have this giant citizen science component where we're asking anyone who's been to the park in the fall ever to send in their photos to help us piece together this puzzle that we don't have answers to because we don't have that consistent data from before the year 2000. I have a UR alum working with me now, and she's going through all of these old newspapers looking for snippets about when fall foliage occurred in Bar Harbor in the past. And we're just trying to add more data to this satellite record to help us piece together whether or not there is a long-term trend there and what variables they could be connected with.
On the one hand, obviously satellite data has this limitation that it only goes back so far. But at least you know that the technology is probably pretty consistent. You know what the technology is. You probably know what the settings of the instruments on the satellites are when they took those pictures. There's a lot of information and consistency in that data. When you start pulling photos from newspapers, from random people who went and took a photo with who knows what camera under who knows what conditions and used filters and altered them, how do you even begin to get actual data that you can reliably know what the color of that tree actually was 20, 40, 60 years ago when somebody took a picture of it?
Well, there's two different answers to that question. We can actually do some image analysis where we look at the amount of reds, greens, and blues in the fall foliage in the picture and normalize them to the other reds, greens, and blues. So we can actually do some quantitative work with the more recent photos. But we're also just looking for if people have pictures in front of Jordan Pond that show the bubbles or on Cadillac Mountain, and hopefully just piecing together a qualitative story like, oh, 25% of the leaves have turned. Oh, 50% of the leaves have turned at this date. 75% of the leaves have turned at this date. The farther back in time, the looser this trend becomes. But it's just sort of to give us an idea of what if what we're seeing is actually a real signal or not.
Those kinds of things that you're talking about there, where you're just trying to get a sense of maybe what percentage of the leaves that have changed, are those things that you could perhaps even tell from black and white photography? I mean, at some point, you're going to run out of people's color snapshots.
Oh, if we get any people's color snapshots, I will be excited. You don't even know. So we are also looking in the archives for black and white photos. I know there are specific labs that have actually saw about our work and have reached out to us to actually help us disentangle what these black and white photos have been. So that just means really fun, even more interdisciplinary collaborative research with other scientists who do image analysis work.
Now, there's one particular data set that I understand that doesn't get you back to black and white photos in the 40s or anything like that. But there's a pancake place in New Hampshire that's actually been collecting data on fall foliage since the mid-1970s. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I stumbled across this on the internet. But this pancake parlor in New Hampshire has been collecting data on the onset of fall foliage, the peak fall foliage, and I think the first snow of the year. And they have this just recorded and they update it every year to help people make decisions as to when to go to New Hampshire to check out fall foliage. And I just thought this was the coolest thing. And I feel like other places exist that must do this, that have this data that we also want. But basically what theirs have shown is really interesting, that it seems like leaves have started to turn earlier every year, but the peak fall foliage that they've recorded has happened later. So I don't know how to even begin to disentangle that, but it was the most fun thing to stumble across.
Talk about citizen science. That's fabulous.
I know. So if you have that record, if someone listening has your own personal record, we would love it. It would save us so much time.
I mean, that's really what you're asking for, is not necessarily anybody who's going to Acadia this year or went last year or even 10 years ago. You're kind of asking, like, did your parents or your grandparents go to Acadia, and can you pull those photos out of the attic? At which point the next question is, how would people get those photos and that data to you?
Right. So we have people sending in photos right now, which is also great. We have signs up in the park, because that actually does help us validate the satellite data to make sure these estimations we're coming up with from the satellite data are actually representative of what's happening on the ground.
So they're sending in photos that are from the past few years
to basically
ground truth the satellites.
That's exactly right. Ground truth. Exactly. And we're getting a lot from the post cell phone camera era, I would say. I understand that it is such a much bigger ask to actually go rifle through photos and scan them. If you're like my parents, you have slides, which I don't even know how you put onto a digital form. But they can send them multiple ways. One of the easiest ways they can just reach out to us and tell us they have these photos is just emailing us at anpfallfoliage@richmond.edu. We will take any, if you scan them and email them to us, that's great. If you actually want to send them to us via mailing address, we can just shoot us an email and we'll send you the mailing address. As someone who still uses a digital camera, I love a hard photo, so I understand. I don't want to take your memories
Absolutely.
Away from you. So if you want to scan them, or we can scan them here and we'll send them back. Truly, whatever is easiest for you, the citizen scientist that wants to help us out with this project and is willing to dig through those old albums.
It sounds like a fun Thanksgiving family project to go back and look at old family vacation photos and then see if they could actually help us understand some of the impacts of climate change right here in New England.
Oh, I love that idea. That's such a great idea. Everyone should do that on Thanksgiving.
Well, and we will, of course, put that email address and links to your research in the Citizen Science Project on our Facebook page. You can look for Living Lab Radio. That's Stephanie Spera. She is an assistant professor of geography and environment at the University of Richmond. She is looking for leaf peeping photos going back as far as you've got them to try to understand the impacts of climate change on fall foliage and tourism in New England. And she recently wrote about her Leaf Peep for Science project on theconversation.com. Stephanie, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Coming up, a new way of estimating ground elevation from satellite data suggests that three times as many people are at risk from rising seas. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A new study out this week says we have dramatically underestimated the risks posed by sea level rise. That, in fact, the number of people who live in areas likely to be underwater at high tide in 2050 is three times what was previously estimated. Under the new scenarios, Bangkok, Jakarta, Mumbai, and huge swaths of Bangladesh and South Vietnam all end up underwater in coming decades. And perhaps most shocking, the difference comes not from new estimates of how quickly or how high the sea level will rise, but from a new way of estimating elevation, where ground level actually is. Joining me now is co-author of that study, Ben Strauss. He's the CEO and chief scientist at Climate Central. Ben, good to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me, Heather.
Explain what the difference is here, that suddenly the risk posed by sea level rise is three times greater than previously thought, but without actual estimates of sea level rise increasing.
Yes. Well, I think the whole climate science community has been very focused on understanding future sea levels, because that's what's changing. But as we were so focused on that side of the equation, we missed a little bit paying attention to the quality of elevation data on land. Or maybe I should say that many of my colleagues and peers recognized that the data we were working with was not well suited to the analysis of populations at risk, but it was the best we had available. And no one imagined that they could improve global elevation data without, say, sending a new satellite into orbit.
Okay, so start at the beginning. What are the current best projections of how much sea level will change by, say, 2050, since that's one of the kind of timelines that you work with in this new study. How much of a change in sea level are we talking about?
The change in sea level itself, we are talking about on the order of 10 inches from 2000 until 2050, over 50 years.
So a little bit less than a foot of sea level rise. I mean, this is not a small number of people when we're talking about this change in the risk posed by sea level rise.
No. One of the surprises for us was the discovery of how many people already live either below the high tide line or in areas below the level of an annual flood. We found more than 100 million, about 110 million people living on land below the high tide line.
Wow.
And 250 million below the annual flood line. Now, that tells us that a lot of people are being protected by coastal defenses because you can't live below high tide unless you're in a houseboat. But it's not clear how effective those defenses will be as sea levels continue to rise. And I suspect that there are a lot of people in the world that we just don't hear about who are suffering and being displaced from their fishing villages and their farms throughout the great deltas on the coasts of Asia and other parts of the world as well.
If 110 million people, by these new estimates, are already living below high tide line, if you add in almost a foot of sea level rise by 2050, how many more people are we talking about being in that risk zone?
Well, we did a little calculation and looked at the first 10 feet or so above high tide and took an average and found that globally there are about 3 million people per vertical inch.
Wow.
So when you hear about, you know, 1 or 2 inches of sea level rise, it may not sound like a lot, but our population, our development is so concentrated in the very lowest elevation bands on our coasts that every inch means about 3 million people.
Benjamin Strauss, given those stakes, that so many people are at the coast and such a small change in elevation can make such a big difference, you've already said that you and colleagues in the field studying sea level rise knew that estimates of ground level were not as good as they should be. But that's a huge risk to take, to not have that information when there are so many people in those zones. So what have the past estimates of ground level, of elevation, been based on? And how did you get, presumably, a better estimate of what ground level actually is?
So the best technology for measuring elevation available today is something called LIDAR, which is basically laser range finding technology. And coastal elevations across the United States have been captured using LIDAR shot from airplanes flying at low altitudes. There's also LIDAR data available for much of Western Europe and Australia. But for the rest of the world, the best elevation data has come from satellite-based radar. And when that radar strikes the Earth, its footprint is pretty large. So it sees buildings and treetops as well as the ground and blends them into a kind of average elevation that we found on average is more than 6 feet above the actual elevation of the ground.
That's a big difference.
It's a big difference when you talk about sea level projections of less than a foot by mid-century, or maybe 2 to 6 feet by the end of the century. So our error in elevation really was dwarfing projected sea levels, the error that we detected. So my colleague Scott Culp and I realized some years ago that it might be possible to use artificial intelligence to very much improve the satellite-based data. We realized we didn't have to fly a new mission. Our bet was that we really only needed to fix the data in places that were extremely simple. That is, flat and low places. That's where the population at risk is.
flat and low and along the coast, you've already limited the areas that you need to look at significantly.
Yes, exactly. So we've limited the areas to look at, and we know that if we build a model that doesn't perform well in a very complex area with lots of hills and mountains and cliffs and bluffs, that doesn't matter so much. Where the large numbers of people at risk are going to be is very flat terrain. And we thought we ought to be able to build a model that can correct for the artifacts in the satellite data. And that's what we did.
How do you ground truth or test this idea that your artificial intelligence results are much more accurate than the previous satellite-based radar data?
So what we did was we started in the United States, where we have accurate LIDAR data for the whole coast. And we've got a very varied topography, so a lot of different test conditions. And we randomly selected 50 million points around our coasts. And we used those points as ground truth to basically calibrate and train the model. We told the model, you have to get these 50 million points right and figure out a model that does that. So our machine learning algorithm did that. And we said, great, but now we have to understand that it works outside of those 50 million points. So first we tested it against the other 99% of land area in the coastal United States that we didn't use to train the model. And in that area, we found that our model reduced the elevation error from an average greater than 10 feet to an error lower than 1 inch. And then we said, well, this is still the United States, and we used data from this terrain to train the model, so let's go someplace completely different. And we used a very large LIDAR data set for the populated coast of Australia, and we found that our algorithm, our model, reduced the error there from over 8 feet to about 4 inches.
Wow. So regardless of what you test this against, it varies in how much more accurate it is, perhaps, but always seems to be more accurate than the previous data. And given what you were saying, Ben Strauss, about where the data was the most limited or where we really only had this lower quality data, it's perhaps then not surprising that where we see the biggest changes with your new estimates of vulnerability are across swaths of Southeast Asia, and in particular in a lot of very large cities, right?
That's
We've got a lot of those buildings that might really confuse the radar data. But I mean, that has huge ramifications. Most of South Vietnam, major cities like Bangkok and Mumbai, where we have dramatically underestimated the vulnerability to sea level rise. Were you surprised by these results and by just how dramatic they were?
I wouldn't say that we were surprised, but we were certainly sobered. And there was a certain shock in seeing the numbers come to life. 5 years ago, we understood there was a problem. Then, after spending a couple of years looking for better elevation data, hoping there would be new, better elevation data, we lost patience and decided to try creating new data ourselves in the way I described. So we knew there was a big problem to be addressed, but that's a different story than when you actually run the numbers and find out the scale and look at the map. And we've, together with our paper that we published in Nature Communications, we co-published a map online that anyone can go to see to look really at any country or city in coastal areas of the world. Anyone can go to coastal.climatecentral.org. And when you look at the map and the difference between what the old data say and the new data say, it's really quite shocking.
How do you respond to those who might say, clearly the previous estimates were way off, we didn't have the right data, we didn't really know what the risks were, maybe we still are not getting it right, and maybe it's not worth worrying about as much as this data might suggest?
Well, I'd hope that they are right. as a human being, of course I hope this research is wrong. Right now it's our best estimate, but I'm under no illusion that we can't do a better job, and I hope this work will help to stimulate those inquiries.
Ben Strauss is the CEO and Chief Scientist for Climate Central and co-author of a new study finding that we have dramatically underestimated the risks posed by sea level rise, particularly in Southeast Asia. Ben, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Arctic is warming faster than any other part of the planet. And as the permafrost there thaws and the tundra burns, it is releasing powerful greenhouse gases that further accelerate warming. Since the permafrost holds three times as much carbon as all the world's forests combined, what's happening in the Arctic is one of the most important aspects of climate change. It's also one of the least understood. For more than a decade, scientists from Woods Hole Research Center have been bringing college students to the remote Arctic to not only learn about how it is changing, but to actively participate in climate research. The experience has changed many students' careers and lives, and many of those students have changed the course of research by introducing original questions and making unexpected discoveries. That's the story of a new book called The Big Thaw: Ancient Carbon, Modern Science, and a Race to Save the World. It features the photography of Chris Linder, and he joins me now. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Heather.
Chris, the photo on the front of the book looks essentially like bubbles coming up through water. You could imagine you're, you know, at a microscopic scale looking up through a glass of soda or something like that. What is the significance of those bubbles? Why are they front and center in this book about Arctic change?
Yeah, so the bubbles on the cover of the Big Thaw book are methane bubbles. And methane is one of the key players in this story, as this carbon that has been locked away, kind of stored in the permafrost freezer for tens of thousands of years since the last ice age. As that soil is now warming and thawing, that carbon becomes available again to microbes. Essentially, it's like taking a steak out of the freezer and eating it. And the process as the microbes eat this ancient carbon is that they respire CO2 and methane. And so as a photographer, this has been one of the most challenging projects that I've ever photographed, in that these are not really photogenic subjects. We're talking about frozen soil and invisible gases. So my challenge was to try to communicate what these look like to someone who's never seen them before. And frankly, most of the world is never going to touch, smell, see, hold permafrost, or see these gases coming out of Arctic lakes. So I had to figure out a way to communicate that in a way that was both beautiful, so that people would engage with the picture and kind of ask questions and want to know more about what's happening.
You have photos in there not only of methane bubbles coming up through lakes, but also trees falling over when the ground beneath them has thawed or melted and literally collapsed. You've got pictures of the layers of the ground with big wedges of ice through them. And then you've got some pictures that almost, they introduce you to the Arctic, but they're almost deceptive, in that you've got these pictures, one in particular of a large field, you know, the tundra, and it kind of looks all the same. And yet you say, when you get up close with it, what that sameness is hiding is a huge diversity of life. I mean, like you said, this is an immense challenge to try to bring people to this place that they will never be and actually try to understand it and portray that accurately.
Yeah, details are really key. And another thing that I love to do with photography, particularly with projects, big projects like this, is to break down stereotypes. So often when I tell people I'm going to Siberia in July, they say, oh, you're going to freeze, and won't you, you know, be scared of polar bears and all of these things that really are not even possible for where we're going to be, because in fact, it can be extraordinarily hot if the wind blows from the south. And one of the biggest challenges can be overheating when you're garbed up in, you know, head to toe in protective gear to keep the mosquitoes off of you. And, you know, it's 95 degrees and you're just sweating inside the suit. with a head net on. So I like to break down stereotypes with my photography. And one of the ways to do that is to photograph all the details that tell the story of the place, that form a collective picture of what this place is like. And a lot of times I'm on my hands and knees in the mud, in the dirt, looking at the really small parts of the landscape that you could just walk right by, but that when you focus on, you see this incredible variety. And when you're near a lake, for instance, in Siberia, on the edges of it, there's this beautiful sphagnum moss that goes all the way around the edges of the lake. The tundra is a totally different environment. You have these beautiful flowers that are only inches high. And if you're looking at them from a distance, all you see is kind of these muted colors and rolling hills. But when you get on your hands and knees, these tiny Arctic flowers that bloom for this short period of time in the summer are just this spectacular variety.
But Chris Linder, this story is only partly about the place of the Arctic and how it is changing. It's also about the people, those who live there, and the scientists who are going there to study and track those changes. And you actually write in the acknowledgments of the book that the most important thing about science is the scientists themselves. What makes you say that?
One of the unique aspects of the Polaris Project that I photographed for the Big Thaw book is that it's an education project and a science project. And the education aspect involves taking a dozen or so undergraduates up to the Siberian or Alaskan Arctic and cutting them loose on the tundra for a month to develop their own research. And for me as a photographer, it was fascinating to interact with the students, to photograph them and interview them. A lot of them had never been out of the country before, and it was their first time traveling abroad when they were in Siberia. This was obviously a life-changing experience for them in that aspect, but also a lot of them, it was the first time they'd ever done real field work and had to formulate a question on their own. And so it was an opportunity for me to see what it was like for a student who had read about science, had learned about science in the classroom, to actually experience what it was like to do science. And this, to me, kind of gets to the heart of what science really is. It's about asking questions and finding answers, you know, in whatever creative way you can come up with to solve that. And it's this creative aspect that, to me, is one of the most fun things about science that is totally gets glossed over by the typical stereotype of science as being very, you know, stodgy and has nothing to do with creativity and is, you know, this whole right brain, left brain, you know, stereotype that's created around science and scientists. But from what I've observed being in the field with scientists is that it's one of the most creative professions that I've ever encountered. Scientists have to be extraordinarily creative when they're having to solve problems in the field.
And one of the themes that comes up in the book over and over is the nature of the interactions between the more senior researchers and these college students who are out there, as you said, for the first time, not only seeing the Arctic for the first time, but formulating questions and experiments for themselves for the first time. And they're coming up with questions that the senior scientists are saying, I would never have noticed that. I would never have thought to ask that. I would have assumed the answer was such and such and therefore not pursued the question. You know, these students are making major contributions to the research that their mentors are really appreciating.
Yeah, it's exciting to see this, you know, thinking outside of the box in every way when they get to the field. And the excitement, too, that they bring to the field is palpable and kind of brings everybody up, all of us. And it's difficult being away from home and, you know, in a new environment for a month, you know, eating different foods, spending long hours in the field. But everybody works together when you're out there in the field. And I think that the experience is just something I wish everybody could experience at least once in their lives, even non-scientists. But and part of my job as a photographer is to convey that so that people have a better appreciation of how science is done and that it's, you know, the passion of the people that are doing it. Unfortunately, I feel like lately, you know, in the last decade or two decades, people have lost trust or faith or, you know, in science and scientific reasoning and results that are communicated. But if people went in the field and for a couple of days, even with the scientists that I know, I think that they would change their minds. You have to know these people. You have to go in the field with them to appreciate just how passionate they are about the work that they're doing and how important they know that it is too, and the pressure that's placed on them to find these answers.
That pressure, and for that matter, the knowledge, the answers that they actually gain, can come potentially with its own emotional toll. I mean, climate change is major stakes, and what they're finding tends to be worse and worse news, not good news, especially for these younger researchers. And I know you not only photographed them, you interviewed each of them. Were they feeling that kind of emotional toll of the knowledge that they were gaining about climate change?
Almost universally, the younger students did not seem affected by the kind of climate change malaise or the, you know, any kind of depression or overwhelming feeling of dread. It was more about, you know, what I got from them was, you know, this is my chance to make a new understanding of this. It's my chance to make a difference. It's my future. And I really think that this is a really key aspect of why this project has been so successful. It's taking this problem that is only going to become more and more of a challenge for the next generation and letting the next generation really take the reins and say, you know, we're driving this now. We are going to drive change. We are going to drive solutions. We are going to drive understanding. And that's really exciting.
That's Chris Linder. His photography is featured in a new book called The Big Thaw: Ancient Carbon, Modern Science, and a Race to Save the World. Chris, thank you.
Thanks very much, Heather.
Up next, technologies developed for space exploration could help make our future here on Earth more sustainable. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Space blankets are wrapped around runners at race finish lines, and memory foam that once protected astronauts is now found in many of our pillows and mattresses. Space exploration and the technology necessary to do it have transformed many lives here on Earth. And the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 says that, quote, the exploration and use of outer space should be carried on for the benefit of all people, irrespective of their degree of economic or scientific development. But of course, that hasn't necessarily been the reality. But that is what my next guest is working toward. Danielle Wood is an assistant professor leading the Space-Enabled Research Group at MIT's Media Lab. Danielle, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Of all the ways that you could work to advance sustainable development and justice here on Earth, why focus on space exploration and space-related technologies?
Space is truly a global location. It's really the providence or the heritage of all humans. Ideally, you could see distributions of benefit to people around the world, benefiting from both the services of space and activities in space. Space is one of several global commons like this, including the ocean, Antarctica, the atmosphere. These are all places where we're reminded that we're not just citizens of countries, but of the planet. And they are places that are somewhat fragile to the way that we live as a society.
Can you give us an example of how you see space-based or space-related technologies specifically supporting and contributing to sustainable development goals?
We identify six particular space technologies that are already shown to have contributions to sustainable development. The six technologies we focus on primarily include satellite Earth observation, satellite communication, satellite positioning, which also helps us with navigation and gives us really accurate timing services. Outside of satellites, we also look at the knowledge and scientific activities gained from microgravity research and human spaceflight. Astronauts who are in orbit around the Earth, such as at the space station, their bones and muscles experience something that's very much like rapid aging because they're not exercising them as they normally would within one gravity. And it helps us understand the experience of people who are aging on Earth. The other two examples are broad technology transfers. You had some great examples up front of items that were invented for some kind of space activity, but were redesigned and transferred to the rest of society. And the final area is fundamental scientific research. There's a lot of economic research that shows that if you want to be good at innovation, you should be funding basic research in the country because you're getting excellent knowledge in your team members. You're going to have infrastructure for computing and for data management, and there's many other links to this kind of benefit.
Daniel Wood, as you go through that list of six technologies that are space-related that could support sustainable development and justice here on Earth, half of them, three of them, are essentially satellite technology. And I wonder what you see as the need or some of the next steps with regard to satellite technology. Is it just about expanding the use and the access to satellites and their services? Or is it about putting different sorts of sensors, different capabilities on satellites? Or is there a more fundamental way that we need to redesign our satellite system in order to make it more equitable and more just?
There's a lot of great stories to talk about with satellites because there's a lot of unique missions, and it's an exciting time. Right now, there's a lot of innovation happening throughout the satellite community. Both governments and private organizations and universities are trying new things. Traditionally, the way you build satellites has been very conservative, meaning we knew the satellites were expensive and expensive to launch, so we were very careful when we launched them to make sure they worked really well. So the traditional idea was to build large-scale satellites that could last for a long time in space and make sure that they were going to work for a long period without mistakes. These days, when we think about satellites, you still have that traditional version. A lot of important government weather satellites use that model, and they do work for a great long time in space, sometimes decades. Another model is what's called the small satellite, and one of my areas is thinking about small satellite engineering. Small satellite is not just the size, it's the philosophy of how you build them. And the concept could be, instead of building one larger satellite that can work for a long time and do many functions or carry many sensors, think about building groups of smaller satellites that can be replaced more often, are more affordable to build, and can be replaced if they do fail. So there's lots of experiments now. There are companies like the company called Planet. They're operating on the order of 200 satellites orbiting around the Earth in what we call low Earth orbit, which is a few hundred kilometers above the Earth. And they're taking imagery of everywhere on Earth every day. And they have different levels of detail. Some of them have about 3-meter resolution. And this kind of information provides much more frequent updates on what's happening with pictures.
I want to go back to this idea of small satellite. Obviously, enabling developing nations to be able to launch perhaps their own satellites that are smaller, they're more affordable, they're more adaptable, to be able to get the kinds of data that they want and need sounds great. But on the flip side of that, shorter lifespan, not spending as much time in space, higher numbers, smaller size, that all sounds like it could have a downside as well, which is more space trash, which you already mentioned as a sustainability issue in space and something that you're working on. So how do you see this trend towards smaller satellites, kind of in a net sense in terms of sustainability?
One of the opportunities we have to make an impact in this area is a collaboration with the World Economic Forum and several other partners, including the European Space Agency, as well as the University of Texas at Austin, and a company called Bryce Space Technology. So that council, working within the World Economic Forum, proposed that there should be a space sustainability rating. The rating is similar to what you might think of for other fields where we want to encourage business people and operators and governments to do something that's good for the environment.
Right. I mean, I've heard of like sustainable wood, sustainable building materials, for that matter, sustainable seafood ratings.
Great point. So many consumers do look for labels on their food to see if their buying was coming from a sustainable kind of farming system and fair to the workers. People look for buildings to be certified with systems that show they're environmentally friendly. So we would like to have the same kind of positive pattern in the space community. So the Space Sustainability Rating aspires to have the same opportunity where operators of satellites, whether they're universities, government, or perhaps companies, satellite operators can voluntarily choose to be rated according to how sustainable their mission is. Now, sustainability here has this very concrete meaning. We're interested in how much a new satellite affects other neighbors in their likelihood of either having a collision or becoming debris. The issue is that in space today, it's a big place, but we have about 2,000 operational satellites now. But there's about 20,000 pieces of trash that are either old satellites or parts from old rockets, and many of them are not doing anything useful right now. And many of them are large enough to cause collisions and break into smaller pieces. So here the idea is to encourage satellite operators of all types to take practical steps and get credit for it if they try to reduce their risk of creating new space debris.
Daniel Wood, as you were listing the six technologies, space-related technologies, that could support sustainable development goals here on Earth, half of those were satellites. The others were related to essentially knowledge and technologies developed as part of a space program that can translate to daily life. As the space arena has become more and more privatized, as private companies have started to play a larger role, and perhaps government-funded and government-run systems have played a smaller role, what does that mean for space sustainability going forward? I mean, you're talking about optional voluntary programs to be sustainability certified. You might have private companies that don't want to share what they've learned from their research or their technology development. Does it make it more difficult for space to be sustainable and to support sustainability here on Earth when the private sector plays such a large role?
I often hear people expressing that they believe that the private sector is getting a larger and larger role in space. And I think I disagree slightly with that summary. What you see right now is the private sector playing quite different roles than it used to, but it's always played a large role because throughout the era, starting in the 60s and going to the 70s, when we had government space programs establishing themselves and then looking for how to complete their work, you always saw the companies playing a key role in implementing the technology, helping to build and operate the technology. And they were often large companies. We've seen a lot of consolidation in the U.S. market, for example, where what starts off as small, separate companies grow into larger ones that end up doing very large government contracts. So that's still true. And the majority of spending in space in the world has a couple different channels. You have a few very large government programs, and you also have a very large commercial satellite television program, where that's a major market that makes profit. A lot of other activities in space don't make much profit right now, but there are many people who are working on that. But the longer-term question for me is asking, what will be happening as new actors, whether they're companies or governments, try to do things that we've not yet seen in space but are becoming more and more feasible? I, of course, aspire to see every country free to operate in space and explore scientific and exploration activities that benefit its people, but in a way that doesn't reduce the long-term safety and sustainability of space for others. This is a fundamental tension, actually.
I was going to ask you about that, because we are seeing more countries getting into space exploration, launching satellites, attempting to land vehicles on the moon. Do you think we are moving in a more sustainable direction, a more equitable direction, perhaps? Or are things just getting a bit more chaotic and harder to maintain sustainability?
So there are established guidelines, for example, to address issues called planetary protection, the question of whether we're going to accidentally take germs or other organic material to a place like Mars or the moon when we don't mean to. I do want to put a note of caution, though, because we're going to see a few things in the next few years we've never seen before. Companies would like to go and try to extract materials and do mining on asteroids. Different groups are preparing to have commercial projects on the moon, but of course with some government affiliation or government support. I think it's wonderful, but I do hope that we can be a little careful because we have a chance to do things that once we do them, we can't undo them. I actually would like to propose that we think of locations like the moon and Mars and asteroids a bit like parks, the way we consider national parks and state parks in the U.S., because they are places that are precious and beautiful and that have not been greatly altered by humans yet. And I think that future generations deserve to enjoy the moon as this beautiful natural environment that it is today.
Daniel Wood leads the space-enabled research group at MIT's Media Lab. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.